Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 314 on Friday, August 8th, 2014. Well, the music you just heard is not the sound of the ocean here at Ocean Park or my usual intro music. It's actually music by my cousins. These are the offspring of my father's brother, Stuart Edgerly, and they're visiting from all over here at Ocean Park in the cottage next to us, which means that every night this past week we've been treated to music that they perform on the porch. They gather each year for a family reunion, four brothers and a sister, and they sing each night on the porch facing the dune. They have guitars, a mandolin, and a dobro, which is a beautiful instrument my cousin from Alaska plays, and they set up music stands with shoot music, and they play their hearts out. I played guitar in second grade in Wayland, Massachusetts, probably about the time they were all starting their music, and I actually had a now famous guitar teacher, Peter Rowan, who tried to lead me to proficiency. In my case, it never took. Meanwhile, my cousins kept on playing. Here's some more from the porch next door. That's my cousin Bruce doing the solo on that song, and you'll hear more of this song at the end of the show in the outro. My guest this week is a teacher of a different kind of music, networking, and social media. She also edits the ebooks and digital publishing blog Telereed, covering everything from the Amazon Hachette negotiations to the latest Kindle software updates. She is Julie Monroe, and I think you're going to enjoy hearing from her.
I think Amazon has done a better PR job. I think that, you know, that they're going to end up getting what they want because I think that Hachette needs them more than Amazon needs Hachette.
In news, there was news concerning Safari Books Online that broke just a few days after my interview last week with Safari CEO Andrew Savickas. And also in news, there's more on Hachette versus Amazon, of course. There is one fewer large company in the e-reader business. There is a new and slower way to get your Amazon packages delivered. And via The Onion, we have a hilarious new Kindle that solves the problem of not being able to let people know that you're reading a Kindle book that would show them exactly how smart you are if they could only see the cover. For the tech tip, I will tell you about the heavy-duty Paperwhite cover from OtterBox. And in content, talk to you about a couple of Fire apps and some summer comics suggestions. If you skip ahead to the end of this episode, you will find out whether you won the drawing for the Nexus 7 tablet that I'm giving away this week. You were eligible to win if you were signed up for the free Kindle Chronicles email newsletter as of this afternoon, Friday, August 8th, 2014. First up in news, Andrew Savickas obviously couldn't talk to me about it when we did the interview last week, but a couple of days later it was announced that O'Reilly acquired Pearson's half stake in Safari Books Online. That's been a joint venture between Pearson and O'Reilly for 11 years, and now O'Reilly is the sole owner. Digital Book World describes it as a vote of confidence for the ebook subscription model that it pioneered on O'Reilly's behalf. And there was a quote from founder Tim O'Reilly on his blog stating, "O'Reilly and Safari will work together to create new features and products." Andrew himself wrote a blog post announcing it, saying, "I'm thrilled to announce that O'Reilly Media has acquired the Pearson stake in Safari, and Safari is now a wholly owned subsidiary of O'Reilly Media, Inc. Safari will continue to operate as an independent company, and Pearson Education will remain a strategic content partner." So, interesting development. I wished I had been able to talk to him maybe the week afterwards so we could get all the details on what's ahead for that move of O'Reilly taking the joint venture in as its own entity, but that might be a good thing to follow up with sometime later. Next in news, Hachette versus Amazon. I read these stories and sort of I don't want to, but I do. I can't not read them. It's sort of like watching a car wreck, especially when the New York Times weighs in as it did today. And what's odd about the story today by David Streitfeld, who I think has had consistently biased coverage of anything having to do with Amazon, with a few lapses of times when I thought he was actually getting a little more even-handed. But this is a really weird one because his story today is basically announcing a full-page ad in the New York Times. It's an ad that's going to be in the Sunday edition at a cost of $104,000, basically making the Hachette case against Amazon, signed by 900-plus authors. I guess if you pay that much money for an ad in the New York Times these days, they sometimes throw in a free, quote, news, unquote, story, letting people know that it's coming. This is just what I think this sad journalistic episode for a paper that I otherwise admire can't get any worse. Here comes a news story that's basically preparing the way for an advertisement. I'm not the only one under whose skin this is getting. J.A. Conrath and Hugh Howey have weighed in with passionate posts attacking Douglas Preston, the author who's the ringleader for the ad. And I'll have to confess, I get tired of it. I probably have some concern that, you know, when you see the number of comments at the Streitfeld story, they're heavily against Amazon, people saying, well, I'm going to stop buying on Amazon. And I don't like to see things like that. I don't like the idea that some kind of movement consciously triggered by a major newspaper could get, you know, anywhere near affecting the business or affecting Amazon's ability to negotiate with the publishers in a way that I think would benefit us as readers and would benefit authors by having ebooks priced in a sensible way and basically by giving Amazon the ability to price in a creative way as opposed to being hamstrung by an agency publishing model by the publishers. So I will confess that these events make me uneasy, even as I'm fairly sure that the business realities of what's happening can't be stopped by things that are taking place in essentially one newspaper with a lot of other people following along. I think one thing that occurs to me as I was reading this today is that it does seem like the temperature's rising, the Streitfeld piece and all the comments, and then also on the other side, the Hugh Howey and the independent authors. People are getting kind of angry. I guess I'm getting kind of angry. And it could be sort of a meta indicator that the end of this impasse is nearing, there's sort of a franticness that could be coming in some intangible way from the negotiations themselves, where it's really getting toward the end game when all of the people clattering on the outside of the negotiations are getting this exercised about it. I'm not sure how long this level of controversy can continue without somebody blinking, and I certainly hope it isn't Amazon that blinks. A more substantive story also came out this week, and that was that Sony is officially getting out of the e-reader business. There was a good story covering this in the Telegraph from London titled "Sony Admits Defeat in E-Reader Battle with Amazon" by Matthew Sparks, deputy head of technology for the Telegraph. He notes that when the Kindle went on sale in the U.S. in 2007, Sony had already been selling its Libre e-reader for 3 years. It was the first one to have an e-ink display, and it was really quite a nice unit. I never owned one, but I saw one, and I did own some of the later Sony e-readers, which are beautifully designed. The hardware was second to none, but they just never did get the secret sauce of making books available in enough diversity with a big enough choice. And then also, of course, the big breakthrough that the Kindle had was that you could order books wirelessly. You didn't have to attach the reader to your computer. And so in the three-year head start, sometimes that kind of a head start just is self-fulfilling in terms of the dominance that a company has as a result. But in the case of Sony, it shows that it isn't always so. I think that's another way to understand that just because Amazon was the first to break through with a successful e-reader, the Kindle didn't assure the success which it has gone on to have. Not only did they have that early entry place with the Kindle, but they kept improving it. And when you look at the current Paperwhite compared with the original Kindle, you can see that it was a sustained effort that led to the dropping out of Sony and kind of the marginalization of Nook at this point, although they're still, making some moves that look like there's still life in that platform, and competition's good, and I think that's fine. But in any event, this is kind of a significant marker when Sony has dropped its operations in Japan. Was the last place that it was operating as a e-book and e-reader provider. And the current model, the PRS-T3, when it sells out, they won't make any more or design a replacement. Sony told German website Lesson today that it's because e-readers are, quote, no longer economically viable. But as the Telegraph writer writes, but Amazon seems to be doing very well out of them. Next is a story that you don't see all the time, and that's Amazon offering slower shipping. The story is that they are announcing an option where you, if you're a Amazon Prime member and you don't need something right away, if you opt for a slower shipping time, you get a credit toward a video. And this is shows up under the options when you buy something as free, no-rush shipping 5 to 7 business days. And if you're willing to wait that long for something, you get a $1 credit toward an Amazon Instant Video. A dollar doesn't sound like much, but you know, you can, a lot of rentals are $1.99 or $2.99. So if you do that a couple of times, you might get yourself a free video to watch. The point here, as has been noted in some of the coverage, is that the shipping costs that Amazon is eating as part of the Amazon Prime program, there has been one price increase since it was instituted, the one in March, from $79 to $99 a year. And so this move looks like a way to probably stem some of the losses that they take in the actual shipping. Of course, if somebody signs up for Prime, they buy lots more stuff. So it's kind of a total strategy that they have. And this is also taking place amidst continuing pressure on earnings. Amazon reported a second quarter loss of $126 million. And I believe their estimates for the current quarter show losses of much higher than that, around $800 million. So they're obviously looking for places to improve the bottom line, even as they fearlessly head into doing things which build for the future at the expense of current earnings. And whether the stock market continues to think that's a good idea, well, time will tell. And finally, a bit of satirical news courtesy of The Onion. This is a video that purports to show a new product called the Kindle Flare, and it pretty much speaks for itself. I'm going to run the whole thing. It's you'll want to see the video, and I'll have it linked to it in the show notes, but I think you'll get the gist of it.
Readers, rejoice! This week, Amazon unveiled the Kindle Flare, the latest model of their popular e-reader. The improved device has the ability to loudly and repeatedly announce the title of the book you're reading so everyone knows how smart you are.
Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut. Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut. Breakfast of Champions by Kurt Vonnegut.
The hot new e-reader includes a massive catalog of titles, a sleek, easy-to-use interface, and a loud, clear voice that barks the name and author of your book on a loop. Amazon says the repetitive shouting is a small feature that makes a big difference.
With one-click downloads, you can see a title you want online, press a button, and within minutes, let everyone around you know that you're reading that big, fancy book by Joan Didion.
Readers say that with crystal-clear 150-decibel stereo speakers, the Flare provides the most conspicuous reading experience yet.
You know, I wasn't planning on getting a tablet. I love that feeling of paper in your hands as you angle the cover for everyone to see, but this Kindle, just as good.
Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius by Dave Eggers.
I've read it before, but I'm reading it again.
It's light, it fits in my bag, it tells everyone on the train I'm reading Murakami.
When you're not reading, the Flare automatically switches into bookshelf mode, which conserves power and reads off a list of everything on your Kindle.
Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy O'Toole.
And if you want to read without broadcast mode, Amazon has you covered.
I don't always feel like telling everyone around me what book I'm in the middle of. So when I'm reading something I'm not proud of, I use auto-explain.
Reading Inferno by Dan Brown. It's silly, but whatever. Also reading Infinite Jest. Also reading Infinite Jest.
Some prominent authors have gotten on board with the new ebook trend. Juno Diaz told TechTrends, quote, "It doesn't matter what the format is. The only thing that matters is getting my work into the hands of readers so they can impress strangers and maybe sleep with someone who thinks they are interesting." And Amazon's competition has also stepped up their game as Apple released a new iPad that whispers, "I have an iPad," over and over again.
The Onion. as an antidote to the serious coverage being given the Hachette Amazon talks. I was hoping to find that the satire outlet has weighed in on that story, but alas, no. A search on the word Hachette at America's Finest News Source, as it proclaims itself at theonion.com, came up with nothing. If one does, then we'll know we are really close to the end of this story. Stay tuned. To follow up on last week's tech tip, I want to let you know that I have been emailing the creator of the Clippings.io tool for retrieving annotations from your Kindles and Kindle apps. It's still not working on my vast trove of highlights and annotations, but Jim Culverwell is hard at work with updates, and I will let you know when the breakthrough is ready to try. I received some tips from a Mayday Tech in response to my questions about battery life on my new Fire phone. I'll have to say the battery life has been pretty disappointing at this point, to the point where I wonder if maybe I'll be asking for a replacement phone. I can actually get by with a quickly depleting battery because I have charging cables at my desk and in my car, and I even have a portable battery in the fanny pack that I wear. And I sort of make a game of always giving the Fire some juice throughout the day. I did the same thing with my iPhone, and, you know, my iPhone didn't last through the whole day without a charge either. But as a competitive disadvantage to other smartphones, this business of battery life is non-trivial. The Mayday Tech suggested turning off Bluetooth when I didn't need it, and the same with Wi-Fi, both of which make calls on the battery. So what this means is that I don't have Bluetooth on unless I'm using my little Bose speaker with the phone, which doesn't happen too much in the house. But when I go to the car, I need Bluetooth, so I just tap on the quick settings and turn Bluetooth on and Wi-Fi off, and then vice versa when I'm in the house. It's kind of a pain in the neck. I'm sure that the four sensors that make the fancy dynamic perspective 3D views, that they're the culprit here, and you can turn that off in the settings, but I'm not willing to do that. One good thing is that the flip of the wrist, one of the gestures on the phone, brings up the quick settings menu quickly, so it is pretty easy to just switch the Bluetooth and the Wi-Fi on and off as needed. I still love this phone, I have to say, sort of the way I remember loving my original Kindle. It's got its kind of hapless aspects, but it's a first child, so to speak. Another problem I'm having with the calendar app on the phone is that got the attention of someone who signed his email chief Amazon engineer. Maybe there's a whole bunch of them, but the middle view of the calendar sets all of my appointments back 3 hours to Pacific time, so I have to remember to use the list view to get the accurate times for my events. They're working on it. There's already been one software update to the phone fixing problems other than the ones that I've pointed out, and I'm sure there will be others. I can imagine Garrett and my other Apple friends snickering at my willingness to put up with these problems, and they're not wrong to mock my utterly forgiving attitude to this new device. I'll just say that every time I reach forward and turn on the lock screen to see a very lively 3D lock screen image appear, it makes me smile, and I'm sure that one of these days I'm actually going to figure out something useful to do with Firefly. I'm having a ball learning the phone and just being one of the first people to try to use it, and I am not embarrassed to say that it still seems like a good idea to have switched from the very elegant iPhone 5S to this pretty scrappy little new device. Julie Monroe has her own business coaching people in networking and social media, and since October 3rd of last year, she has been serving as editor of the ebooks and digital publishing blog Telereed. I caught up with Julie by Skype on Wednesday, August 6th at her home in Springfield, Virginia, which is just outside of Washington, D.C. I began by asking her what readers will find when they check out Telereed at telereed.com.
They'll see a variety of things, mostly focused around digital publishing and technology. So we do a lot on e-readers, e-reading, smartphones. We try to keep it with a focus on e-reading or publishing. We talk about self-publishing. You know, we obviously write about, you know, the news of the day when it comes to publishing or technology, but I also try to go for some how-to articles. So, I mean, I've got an article that gets a lot of hits. Help, my Kindle keeps freezing. Every month, that gets a good 200 hits.
How large is your audience?
We get about 3,000 visits a day.
What do you shoot for in terms of the amount of new content you're putting up?
I shoot for at least 5, and some days we make it, and some days there's enough going on that we go over that.
And it's you and Chris Meadows?
Chris Meadows and Paul St. John McIntosh, who's our British correspondent living in Hungary, and Joanna Cabo, who covers most things Canadian. She also does more lifestyle pieces than the rest of us do.
In 10 months, have you kind of put your stamp on it as the editor?
Not so much in terms of content, although I am trying to find, I'm doing some SEO research, trying to find keywords that are going to bring in that consistent new visitors. We love our existing readers, and I want to keep them, but I want to bring in new readers as well. So I've been going out and hounding Kindle boards, K-boards now, mobile read, trying to find what are the questions people are asking, what do people want to know, and trying to do posts around that. The previous editor, great guy, probably better than I am at making the posts look pretty, but he was so overwhelmed he didn't have time to go and do that research. So that's what I've been doing. I've also been really focusing on SEOing each post to make sure that we're out there to be the site that people find when they put in certain search terms.
SEO, search engine optimization.
Sorry, it's so much a part of my world I forget to say it out.
And let's fill in the rest of your world. You have a business in the DC area. Tell me about that.
I'm a networking and social media coach, so I help people effectively word of mouth market themselves. And it's been a nice tie-in to Telerede because it's part of the reason that I've, with my social media, and I do some SEO for some of my clients. So it's been a really good intersection of skills.
And are you dividing your time about half and half?
No, I would say I'm more probably three-quarters one-to-one discovery, one-quarter Telerede, and then one-quarter being a fiction writer. And yes, I know that doesn't add up.
And your fiction is about vampires, I see.
Well, actually, the main character is a warlock, but he does have a vampire partner. But everybody assumes it's a vampire story, even though the warlock is the main character.
Well, and I'll confess my ignorance. What's the difference between a warlock and a vampire?
Well, a warlock he's a male witch, so he's human. He just has magical powers, as opposed to the vampire, who is obviously, blood-sucking and supernatural creature and all that.
And these characters, you've got three books in this series, all set in Washington, D.C., so they're all kind of prowling the halls of Congress and things, or?
I've stayed away from Congress. There are too many monsters in Congress. They are far worse than anything that my characters have.
Let's switch to your history with ebooks and e-readers. I can tell that you have been at this longer than I have because your first e-reader was a device that I don't think I had heard of, the Handspring Visor Deluxe. What can you tell me about that piece of equipment?
Well, it was basically a third-party Palm Pilot. It used the Palm operating system, but it was manufactured by another company. Actually, the guy who started the company was one of the creators of the Palm Pilot. The Handspring Visor was different from the Palm Pilot in that it had this little slot in the top that you could stick cards in that were supposed to add additional functionality. A really, really cool idea that didn't take off because there wasn't enough third-party development.
And this is
but we're talking black and white, 60x60 pixels, and yes, that's how I did all of my. That's how I discovered ebooks and started doing e-reading.
And that was 15 years ago or so.
Yeah, it was 98.
Wow, where's the Rocket Book compared to that? Does that come after that?
The Rocket Book came after that. Yes, and I never had that. The Sony PRS-505. Was my first official e-reader.
And what's your mix of e-reading devices now?
I have a Kindle Paperwhite. I have a Nook HD that I have flashed Cyanogen Mod 11 on.
Now, what does that mean?
It's basically a custom version of Android KitKat. There's a group called Cyanogen Mod that they take it, because Android's open source, they take it, they modify it, and then it's basically available for download onto devices that maybe don't use the same version of Android that you would like. And I occasionally read on my iPad, but it's probably the one I do the least reading on right now.
And how about the Nexus 7? You still use that?
I sold it after I started using my Nook HD more than my Nexus 7. One can only effectively use so many devices.
Have you ever had one of the Kindle Fire devices, the Amazon tablets?
No, because I don't like the Amazon App Store. I don't like the limited selection, and I don't like the fact that they tend to be one or two upgrades behind. So even if they have an app that's available in Google Play, the Amazon version may be 4 to 6 months out of date. And I'm one of those people who likes to be more on the edge than that.
You know, and I just bought the Kindle Fire or the Amazon Fire phone, so I'm subject to those same constraints in terms of the apps that are available to it. Are the apps on the Google Play Store, are they vetted and sort of safe to use in the same way that Amazon seems to be trying to vet the apps that show up on the apps for Android store at their site?
Yes. If you install apps from Google Play, Google has a mechanism to vet the apps, and they have a mechanism to verify the apps when you're downloading them from the store. Generally, if you pick up a virus on an Android device, it's because you've installed an app from a third party. You know, you've maybe downloaded an APK
right.
from a site that you shouldn't have. So you're fairly safe. I mean, I won't say there's no malware in Google Play, just like I'm sure you could pick up malware from the Apple Store if you weren't really, really careful. But for the kinds of apps that most people are going to use, you're not going to pick up anything nasty from them.
Well, now, I have tried to bring APK files over to my Fire and also from the Fire phone. There was an app I found for my bank, and I was able to find it, I think, in the Google Play Store, and I used one of these third-party sites, and it crashed the phone. I all of a sudden, nothing worked. Are there any safe ways to do that, or are you always subject to problems if you try to kind of force Google Play apps onto one of the Amazon devices through the .apk file?
I believe that not everything works as smoothly as you'd like. Since I've never had a Kindle Fire, I don't have practical experience with that.
Yeah.
That's, like I said, that's one of the reasons I didn't get one. I mean, they're beautiful devices. I love the screen. I like what they have under the hood. But after my first Nook Color, when I was so limited in what apps I could buy, I basically said, I'm not going to buy a device again if I can't get on the major app store for the operating system. I didn't buy a Nook HD until they opened up Google Play on it. Even though I had been lusting after one for months because they have a gorgeous screen, I just didn't do it. As soon as they opened up Google Play on it, I ran out that day and bought one.
Now, are there still more apps at the iTunes App Store than there are at Google Play?
I think so. It's one of those horse races that doesn't really mean much. You know, the major ones you want, you can get in both places. Who really cares if one has 1 million and one only has 900,000? Who's going to install that many apps anyway?
Right. Does Amazon have any hope of ever catching up?
I don't think so. And it's because of how the developers look at things. The developers in general, they develop for iOS first because it's a more profitable platform. Then they may go to the Amazon store, to Google Play, and then they've got to have a compelling reason to go to Amazon. So I don't think they ever will, because why would they want to develop for three different stores if they didn't have to?
And the third store certainly has a smaller installed base at this point.
Yes. And what's frustrating is there are apps in the Amazon App Store that are not Kindle Fire compatible. At least there used to be. I suppose that may have changed. But for a while, I was seeing apps that were in the Amazon App Store, but you couldn't install them on a Kindle Fire, which just seemed wrong to me on so many levels.
Yeah, I think that's still the case. Well, now, Telerita, you've covered the Hachette Amazon negotiations pretty thoroughly and have obviously been watching it. What do you think is going to happen there? Is it going to take another year for this to be resolved, and is one side or the other pretty much going to cave? Or
I don't think it's going to take a year. I know that we're seeing the articles now about how Kensington took 18 months, but Kensington and Amazon didn't hold that negotiation in public.
Right.
I think Hachette made a bad mistake in starting to open it up to public opinion. Amazon is very, very good at what they do. They have a very loyal following. I mean, if you think about it, how many readers know Amazon versus know the other name? You know, if you're reading articles and you've got this one company that you don't know saying some stuff, and then you've got Amazon saying something else, I think people in general are listening to Amazon, assuming they're paying any attention at all, which there's also some definite indications that the only people who care about this are people like me who write about it. So I think Amazon has done a better PR job. I think that, you know, that they're going to end up getting what they want because they, I think that Hachette needs them more than Amazon needs Hachette. And I think that's how it's going to end up playing out. I don't know. I would guess maybe another 3 to 4 months. Nobody can cave too quickly, but I'd be surprised if it took a full 18.
What do you make of the sort of pitting one set of authors against the other? And
it's a terrible idea. There's an author I really, really used to like and would buy his books as soon as they came out. He's one of the authors who has signed Douglas Preston's petition and has been kind of outspoken. And his newest book is still sitting as a sample on my Kindle, and I haven't bought it. And yeah, that's part of the reason I haven't bought it, is because I've lost some of my reverence for this particular author. And my suspicion is there's enough people out there like me who are going, well, you know what? I could spend, I think his book's $11.99 or $12.99, I'd have to check. Or I could go buy 3 or 4 indie published books from people who aren't out there making fools of themselves in public.
Yeah.
Not indie authors don't make fools of themselves in public. Don't get me wrong. If you've ever wandered the Writer's Cafe on K-Boards, there are certainly some outspoken people there.
I'm just amazed that an author would weigh into this when the publishing business is so complicated these days and the chances of getting it wrong are pretty high.
Well, I've also wondered if they didn't get some talking points.
Mm.
It happens so quickly and it happens so vehemently that I have to wonder if there wasn't some seeding of comments out there. I don't know that for sure. I'm just speculating based on how quickly it happened and how united a certain number of authors have been.
Let's talk about digital rights management. Why have so many publishers protected their content with DRM? What are they trying to do, and how did we get here?
I think they thought they had to. I think they thought it would be effective. There are authors out there who are very, very concerned about piracy and are just horrendously offended when they find one of their books on a pirate site. And so a publisher can go to those authors and say, we're doing these things to help make sure that doesn't happen, and that's what DRM is. I think that there is some view that lock-in is not a bad thing. They do want to control the content. They would rather that if you move from a Kindle to a Nook, that you had to go buy the content again. I mean, why wouldn't they want that? So DRM is seen as one way to either keep people locked into one platform, or if they're going to change platforms, they're going to have to buy the books again. Consumers obviously think that's a terrible idea, and for good reason. Everything that traditional publishing does, we're seeing the pull between the business interest and the consumer interest, and they're not in sync. And so DRM gives them the illusion of doing something for when the authors come back and say, hey, I found my book on a pirate site, and it gives them control.
Well, and if you were hired as a consultant at Random House or one of the big five to turn it around and go the other way, what arguments would you use internally to the authors and to the people at the publishing house that the sky would not fall if you took an open DRM approach?
Well, look at what's happened to Tor Forge, the imprint of Macmillan that removed all DRM and a year later said it had no impact whatsoever on their sales. I think that's a pretty good case. You can also do this. You could also look at the example of Bay and Books. They never put DRM on their titles, and they were leaders when it came to electronic publishing. If you look at those case studies, and okay, they could dismiss Bayon because, well, you know, they were one of those little kind of, you know, independent sort of ish publishers. They're not one of us. Well, Tor Forge is one of them. And they have said it made no difference in their sales when they removed DRM. I do know of readers who have an explicit loyalty to Tor Forge because of that decision. They will only buy their science fiction fantasy from them or from Bayon, and they won't buy from other publishers because of the DRM.
Well, I've been surprised because I think Tor has been open now for close to 2 years, and I think Cory Doctorow told me that the Macmillan people were really watching it, and he was hopeful that it would expand to their other imprints, but it hasn't. Why is that?
It surprises me that Macmillan hasn't opened up their entire catalog. I don't know. I guess they can say it's a particularly passionate community, sub-community. I don't know. I mean, they can justify it any way they want. The reality is, it's not really a justifiable decision. I release all of my books without DRM because it's something I'm passionate about. And yes, you know what? I found my book on a pirate site. Yay! I was actually kind of excited the first time it happened. I'm not worried about it. I'm well aware that pirates fall into a couple of categories. There's the, I am, therefore I pirate. They weren't going to buy my book anyway. There are the people who do it because they don't want to lose control over their content. Well, I've given them DRM-free content, so they don't have a reason not to buy. And if there's somebody who can't afford it, well, you know what? Fine. Go off and pirate it, like me, and buy me when you can afford it. I'm just not that worried about it.
Well, you've written that you purchased pirated books in the past. You don't anymore.
I won't say I purchased them.
You got them. You acquired them. So why did you then and why don't you now?
I did then because it was about the only way to get ebooks. When I remember 1998, there were no commercial ebook stores. I stumbled one day across this little site that you needed a password to get into, and I discovered a treasure trove of about 100 science fiction titles. And I thought, like, wow, 100 science fiction titles on a site. This is like the best thing ever. So I downloaded them. As soon as books became commercially available in e-format, my reason for pirating them went away. I don't mind buying the content, but if I couldn't buy it in the format I wanted, I didn't have a moral issue with pirating it. As soon as it became available in the format I wanted, I started buying. So I don't pirate anymore because I don't need to. There's plenty of stuff out there at a price I'm more than willing to pay.
And I think I've seen you say that you routinely strip the DRM from books you do buy just because you want them to be easier to use, or what's your thinking there?
Exactly. I want to use them on whatever device I feel like reading. As I said, right now I'm reading on a Kindle Paperwhite and a Nook and an iPad. Some days I read in Mobi format, some days I read in EPUB. I want to have that option. I want to be able to do what I want to do with it.
And once you take the DRM off, you can make versions in Mobi or EPUB or whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. I generally buy from Amazon, strip the DRM, and archive in EPUB.
Is that illegal? Are you in danger of being hauled off to jail for doing this?
Potentially, but I don't think anybody really cares enough to come after me. I would never and have never uploaded anything to a torrent. Even when I did download pirated content, I never uploaded anything. I was simply a downloader. So I'm buying the stuff. I'm stripping the DRM, yes, which technically is illegal, but I'm only using it for my own purposes. I'm not giving it away. I'm really not somebody that it would be worth them coming after.
What about the iBook store? Do you do the same thing there? Are you buying any books from iBooks?
I do not buy from iBooks because they use a different... There is a method to strip the DRM. It's a different method, and I haven't... I know how to find it, and I could probably figure out how to do it, but it's too much hassle because I know how to do it, and it's pretty seamless from Amazon. But that is one of the reasons I won't buy from the iBook store, because I like to be able to format shift my content.
There was a piece today that showed up at Telluride about Booklamp, which is, there was a similar thing which would find music based on kind of algorithms analyzing the music. And as I understand it, that's what Booklamp does. It helps you find books you might want to read by deep dive into the data of keywords and things.
As I understand, since I haven't done anything, I have never tried out Booklamp, but from what I understand, that's what it does. And if it does what it says it does, it's a really great discovery tool. Because according to William Richards, that's a gentleman who blogged about it, and I linked to his blog post, he says it's smart enough to tell, okay, you like early Heinlein, but you don't like late Heinlein, and it will make recommendations based on the writing style of early Heinlein versus recommendations on the writing style of late Heinlein. Well, if it can do that, that's pretty cool.
Amazon doesn't have any capability to do that kind of recommendations because they're mainly just working off books that sell larger volume.
Or if you bought this, you might have also, people may have bought that, which doesn't mean they necessarily liked it. I mean, I buy books that I don't like. So my recommendation could come up as, she bought this, so she also bought that, and maybe I didn't like either one of them. So it's an easy way to do a recommendation. It's not a bad way to do it. Potentially Booklamp could be better. If Apple plans on taking good advantage of that, more power to them. They still have the lock-in problem, which is why I said in my article it would be ironic if Apple became a showroom for Amazon. If people go to iBooks to find books and then go to Amazon to buy them, I'd probably do it. But then I'm kind of rebellious that way.
I see. Well, what's next for Telluride?
Continuing to do more of the same. I wouldn't mind another writer. So if there's somebody out there who's listening who is passionate about digital publishing and technology, I'd be happy to have them contact me, because my writers do a great job, but sometimes they want to go on vacation, and or you know they run out of stuff to write for a couple of days, and it'd be nice to have one more person producing content. So yeah, if anybody out there is passionate about this, contact me and I'd be happy to talk to them about writing for us.
Can you say how much you pay? Or
they're paid positions. They're not very well paid positions. So no one's going to get rich at it, but it's not some bad fun money. When I started writing, I basically looked at it as financing my technology love. I basically plowed the money that I made for writing for Telluride back into more gadgets.
In comments, I want to pass along an open letter to Amazon written by Eolake Stubblehouse in the UK, longtime listener, and it's titled, "Please Make a Pocket-Sized Kindle Fire." He writes, "I recently bought a Windows phone with a 6-inch screen with HD resolution. And to my surprise, in this I think I have found the ideal portable e-reader device, in form at least. The phone, phablet, is in most aspects giving me the best e-reading experience I've ever had. The screen of this device is 6 inches, measured diagonally as usual, meaning a little smaller than the Kindle Fire 7-inch device, which I really like, but the outer form is significantly lighter and rather smaller than the Kindle Fire, and this suddenly makes it significantly more pocketable, and more importantly, much more comfortable to hold while reading. But phones are expensive and complicated. A dedicated e-reader of this size would be better, and Amazon is the most likely source of such a device. We don't need anything radically new, we just need a smaller Kindle Fire, just an inch smaller screen-wise, and I believe it could be brought down to maybe under 200 grams, and a size which lets it sit comfortably across any adult palm, thus enabling reading sessions of any length without discomfort. I believe that a pocket-sized Kindle Fire would expand the market and make reading on the whole more comfortable and more attractive than ever before, thus widening the appeal to the general public. Sincerely yours, Eolake Stubblehouse." So I find the suggestion by Eolake quite compelling, because I do enjoy reading on a color screen that offers fast links to internet pages from within the book I'm reading. I use my Kindle Fire 7-inch for this now, and I can imagine that I would enjoy a slightly smaller device, as Eolake suggests, especially if the price was appealing, maybe just under $100. So I'd be curious what you think. You can email me with your reaction at podchronicles@gmail.com. In content, I'm going to list some comic titles from Comixology, which is owned by Amazon. Now, these come from Casey Huebner, and I'll give you a sample of his annotations to these. He talks about one called Mouse Guard, lovely stories of a field of mice, their civilization, and war against predators. Edison Rex, this comes from Monkey Brain Comics. They are a digital-only house that helps independent stories get told. Edison Rex is a classic Superman story, but what if the bad guy discovers that the superhero really is a ticking time bomb sent to destroy us? He talks about a new Batman series. DC Comics rebooted their comics in 2011. I bought that one on his recommendation, and on the Fire Phone, it's very snappy in terms of how the panels move across, and great graphics, fun to read. Batman 66 is another one. There's one called Daredevil and Hawkeye. Those are both from Marvel. There's obviously some great stuff to read in comics and graphic novels on these tablet devices. I want to know more about it, so I really appreciate getting that list from Casey. For content on the Fire Phone, there is a Dropbox application I was glad to see, so that's something I can use the way I used on my iPhone. Before I leave you with some more music from my cousins, I want to let you know who won the Nexus 7 at approximately 3:40 p.m. Eastern Time today, August 8th. There were 276 people on the Kindle Chronicles free newsletter list that I maintain at MailChimp. I used a random number generator at random.org to choose number 253, and following down the rows of the spreadsheet, found that the 253rd name on it was that of Lee Ryan. I will wait till Monday to email the winner with the news so that there's a chance to hear it first on the podcast. Thanks for listening. Here's some more music from Ocean Park, Maine, courtesy of my cousins on the porch next door.
How my girls came love.